Thank you for listening to this A&O podcast series on how to make hydrogen projects a success. My name is Jochem Spaans, and I'm a partner in our Amsterdam projects group focusing on industry and climate change. In this three-part podcast series, we will share our practical experience doing hydrogen projects in the Netherlands and globally, update you on developments in the Netherlands, and discuss our lessons learned. In this third and final part of our podcast series, we will focus on the experiences we've built in the Middle East and Asia-Pac. I will be speaking with Michael Diozzi, an A&O partner based in London, who previously spent 12 years in the Middle East, working on larger energy projects. Michael focuses on large energy transition projects and is one of the partners driving our global hydrogen practice. I will also be speaking with Matthias Vos, who has been with A&O for over 25 years. Matthias has primarily been working on large power energy projects and on petrochemical projects in Asia-Pac. Michael, could you start us off with what's happening in the Middle East? Are any hydrogen projects on the rise?
Thanks, Joachim. I think it's right. It makes sense to start with the Middle East, because one thing that's really clear is the GCC and North Africa are going to lead the world in large-scale green hydrogen production. I'm right now with another Alan Overy teams are working right now on three multi-billion dollar integrated green hydrogen production facilities, one in Saudi, two in Oman, one on the lender side and two on the sponsor side. We're working on one in Morocco and talking about several others in Morocco and Egypt. So it's very real. There's tens of billions of dollars of projects that are already up and running. And it's interesting to look at why these are on the rise there. You really need to look at it, I think, in context as to why the Middle East and Europe, for example, are taking slightly different approaches. So when you look at that context in the Middle East, that you've got this urgent need to diversify petro-economies there, and we know that. But the governments there are doing so by playing to their advantages. So what are they? Well, firstly, you've got the world's cheapest renewable power, especially solar, and you need a lot of that, to electrolyze water. Secondly, you've got vast tracts of unused land owned by the government, and a willingness to make that available at very low cost, and in some cases to build peripheral infrastructure, dedicated infrastructure, such as ports, pipelines, grid connections outside of project ring fences. So your CapEx can really focus on the hydrogen production itself. Thirdly, you've got fantastic geographical positioning on major shipping routes, very established hydrocarbon supply and distribution chains already. Moving commodities, hydrocarbon commodities is in some senses what the Middle East does best, and a very deep regional understanding of how commodity markets work. And you play all of this out in a relatively light regulatory environment within the gift of your host government. So all of that's led Middle East governments and North African governments, particularly Saudi, Oman, UAE, Morocco and Egypt, towards gigascale production of green hydrogen on a scale that Europe can only really dream of, I think. You do, of course, also have the established hydrocarbon production players looking very closely at building out their blue hydrogen production. And actually, we've done, Matthias, you worked on our first export of blue hydrogen from the Middle East to Japan. So it's not a surprise, I think, that it's coming from there. Those projects are seeing some common themes. Firstly, they're enormous. They're typically structured as JVs between state-owned NOCs or sovereign wealth funds and major industrial players. And I'll come back to your JV strategy perhaps a little bit later on. They are likely to be structured as fully integrated projects across the renewable power, the hydrogen electrolysis and nitrogen fixing to produce ammonia, which you can ship more easily. And lastly, they're all likely to employ some form of long-term offtake or tolling structures to enable a stable revenue line to access long-term debt. And that's a little different to what we're seeing in Europe.
Yeah, well, I think with your experience in the Middle East and now back in London, you'd be the best place to tell us what is the difference. So what's the difference if you compare that story to what's happening in the EU then?
So it all comes back to what your fundamental advantages are. And you don't have that same context in Europe. So what we're seeing there tends to be smaller in scale. Or otherwise they're focusing on either a sort of power to X or using hydrogen as part of wider industrial processes. So I'm acting on the world's, I think, first, certainly largest green steel project financing at the moment in Sweden, where they're looking at a 750 megawatt electrolyzer to produce green steel for the automotive industry. So you will see those, and you're seeing that and a lot of development of energy transition projects in the Nordics, because you've got Europe's cheapest renewable power there. So you're seeing some large-scale things there. Otherwise, at the moment, things are still smaller scale in Europe. Countries such as the UK focusing a little more on blue hydrogen. They're not as focused on large-scale green hydrogen. Again, playing to local geographic realities and geological realities. You know, the UK has an old oil industry where we have the geological ability to pump CO2 back into these oil fields. Well, that's going to take you more down a blue route than a green route in the UK. At least that's the government's approach. The European projects that we're seeing are centered more on domestic and EU supply rather than large-scale commodity export, normally around existing industrial centres or ports, and that plays very much to you in Holland, I know, and potentially blending into existing heating grids, which, again, you don't have in countries like the Middle East. And above all, I think the main thing is they're looking primarily to government subsidy business models, the kind of things that we were just hearing about, for revenue support, rather than the long-term offtake. So that you're seeing the differences because of these sort of different realities and political realities, political and geological realities on the ground.
Well, thank you. Matthias, welcome to you as well. How does all of this compare to what you see in Asia?
Thanks, Jochem. If I may, I would like to include Australia in the Asian story, because sure. I think hearing Michael just waxing lyrically about what's happening in the Middle East, which is no doubt spectacular, I think Australia is very much looking to give the Middle East a run for its money. But when you look at Australia and Asia together, it's quite a diverse picture, much more so than in the case of Europe or the Middle East. There are some discernible trends, and some of those will not be very surprising. So when you look at Northeast Asia, Japan, Korea, they are very much emerging as major off-takers and importers of hydrogen. Well, there will be some production, but they don't look to produce most of the hydrogen they need themselves. And the focus is very much on use of hydrogen in the transportation and power generation sectors. There is an overriding theme here, which is very much around energy security. Against that backdrop, you have a big focus on the establishment of integrated international hydrogen supply chains to allow for the import of hydrogen to these countries. So as Michael has already mentioned, we're spending a lot of time at the moment working with clients out here, helping them to design these supply chains and also helping them with investments at various levels of these chains. It's probably also fair to say, a bit like Michael's reference to the UK, that there is overall a less purist approach out here when it comes to the colours of hydrogen involved. So take Japan as an example. Japan's strategy envisages the use of any colour of hydrogen, be it green, blue, pink, yellow, which I think is a new creation to describe nuclear-generated hydrogen, or even grey. Because at least initially, I think the thinking is that, well, if it helps create a market and create demand, and if it helps to bring down costs, then by all means, let's go for it. Although it's probably also fair to say that there is official encouragement to go for what's termed as low-carbon hydrogen, which I find very interesting, as appears to be a term borrowed from Europe in this context. It's also important to note that the geography out here is very different from, say, Europe. We don't have a developed pipeline network. And obviously, when you look at Japan being an island and other countries, there is a big focus here on streamlining transportation by ship be that in the form of liquid hydrogen, ammonia, or MCH, because that will ultimately have a very big impact on costs. The transportation costs are a big factor in the importation of hydrogen to, say, for instance, Japan. And there is also an aspect of the facility of use when you arrive for things like ammonia and MCH. You have existing regulations and receiving terminals, facilities, and so on. So not surprisingly, perhaps, but in Japan, there is a major focus on importing ammonia for co-firing in thermal power plants, be that gas and also coal, actually. And the eventual aim here is really to unlock sort of the potential for hydrogen-based power generation capacity somewhere in the range of between 15 and 30 gigawatts in the long run.
And when we look at Australia, how are they positioning themselves?
There are a lot of parallels with the Middle Eastern country and the story that Michael has been telling. Australia is very much positioning itself as a key supplier to Asia, and that's not very surprising when you take into account that that Australia is the closest major supply center to most Asian and Northeast Asian countries, which dramatically reduces transportation costs. It has the benefit of a highly developed and well-tested LNG industry, which comes with highly developed know-how and tested infrastructure. And talking of scale, some of the projects that are under review here are true mega projects. I mean, we see some projects in the range of 25 and 50 gigawatts that is quite impressive. Australia's export vision is not really limited to Asia, though, and there's also already existing cooperation arrangements with some very exotic and far-flung places like Germany, for example. So there's a global vision for Australia here as well. One other aspect that is noteworthy and I think also logical when you look at Australia's more traditional economy, that there is a real drive coming out of Australia to promote green hydrogen in the mining area and also in related sectors. So it's not a coincidence that Andrew Forrest's FFI, for instance, is becoming a real driving force for green hydrogen, both in Australia but also well beyond, I think, almost everywhere in the world, as far as I can tell. And also mining giants such as Rio Tinto and others are these days pursuing quite aggressive carbon reduction programs. And for instance, we're already seeing in Australia some real projects like the proposed hydrogen plant for Rio's Yarwun alumina refinery.
Well, thank you, Matthias. I think your contributions make clear that although there are some similarities, for instance, in the scale that we in the Netherlands can only dream of, I think the differences in doing projects around the globe are manifest as well. But that being said, Michael, what in your view are the key structuring issues or elements for sponsors and lenders to be aware about in these type of projects?
I'd pick out four or five key structuring issues, I think, for developing and financing these large hydrogen projects. Of any size, really. Look, firstly, structuring your JV, selecting the right partners. And this all really depends what you're trying to achieve. And it depends a lot whether your project is integrated or non-integrated. And so that's a really fundamental initial decision for a sponsor. So an integrated project will combine power generation and storage, typically to address intermittency on the green, on your renewable power. For your green hydrogen, electrolysis to produce the hydrogen, and then probably a nitrogen, if you're shipping it, possibly a nitrogen fixing process to produce ammonia, which is much easier to ship. And that's the main model in the Middle East, where you don't have excess power generally available to tap on the grid. We don't yet have green guarantees of origin either, although I think they're on their way. So they are tending towards sort of large-scale integrated projects. Europe, I think, is likely to be a mixture, and you'll see more non-integrated models. So you can sign a private wire PPA with a guarantee of origin for your power, and you can use that to make hydrogen or green steel or green batteries or whatever. Or if you're a power developer in Europe and you want to get into the hydrogen market, and we're talking to those sorts of clients now, you know, you can do that yourself, or you can to produce the hydrogen yourself and go and procure electrolyzers and feed them with your own power, or you could effectively toll the hydrogen production. You know, you can provide the power and offtake the hydrogen, but someone else does the electrolysis for you and you pay them a tolling processing fee. Or you can produce both and then you arbitrage whether you sell the hydrogen or you can turn it back into power, for example, using hydrogen really as a storage vector for excess offshore wind power, for example, that's not yet needed by the grid. Do you then sell the hydrogen or do you convert it back into power when the price has gone up on the power side? You can arbitrage the two. So look, depending what you want to do, your JV partners will vary. You know, if you need to produce 4 gigawatts of power for your electrolyzers, you'll want to go and talk to power developers. If you need an air separation unit and obviously an electrolyzer, you go talk to the big players there. And in the emerging markets, you would typically bring in a host government. We talk a lot to clients about how to do that, whether you get a host government agreement, what that looks like. And then you have the big industry players and alongside this great green wall of private capital that's very keen to get involved. So that's your JV and I suppose your equity. Then if you're looking for project finance, well, you have, I suppose, the usual bankability issues of construction strategy and the extent to which completion support will be required and is available. Any project-on-project risks for non-integrated projects, if you are disaggregating it, and obviously the infrastructure to get your product to market. But above all, I would start with the revenue story. You will need an offtake strategy of some kind, and that means addressing the key issues of volume and pricing risk. And there you've got an offtake. You've kind of got three main choices. You can have a single contracted offtaker, you can have multiple contracted offtakers, or you can have a sort of fully distributed model like a retail petrol station or at key transport hubs. And you can look to take some market risks in the way that you might do on an oil and gas or a petrochemical project. That merchant story is still very difficult to bank in a world without an established spot market for green hydrogen or green ammonia. So debt markets are looking for some form of underwrite of risk on the offtake side. And that can only really come from one of two places. And I've heard big industry players describe it in this way. It either comes from the government as a front for the consumer or the taxpayer. And we're seeing that, you know, in some of the European business models, for example, particularly in the UK, which is quite a developed one strategy at the moment. So if it's not a government, it's one or more private or actually possible government off-takers. And that's how we're seeing the Middle East projects develop and certain of these more captive projects in Europe, like the Green Steel or refineries who need hydrogen for their industrial processes, for their refining processes. So yes, you know, you've got these CapEx subsidies, but it's the revenue top-up models in Europe where for the wider market, we're seeing a lot of players really wait and they are trying to get organized, getting their JVs set up, trying to get their offtakes, you know, to the extent they got contracted offtakes, get those sorted. But the economic viability is still really dependent on a government model coming through. On the offtake side, just to finish on the offtake side, there are a lot of interesting questions, and we're having a lot of fun solving them at the moment on projects, particularly in the Middle East, as the sort of ones the most advanced at the moment. You know, how do you, as an off-taker, give a take-or-pay commitment, which is what lenders would love? You don't have to do it that way. But how do you give that and take pricing risk for the sort of tenor you want for long-term debt? You know, what is the green premium an off-taker can expect to achieve? We've got a spot price for grey ammonia. I'm not sure there's one yet for blue, but we don't have one for green. You know, how much will lenders want to look behind that offtake to distribution channels and the on-sale strategy for the offtaker? And what happens on termination? If you're really dependent on this offtake contract and there isn't so much of the fallback, well, there is a grey fallback market, but not a green one. You know, when you're doing your QRA analysis and your Monte Carlo analysis and the modelling, you know, how much are you looking to fall back to green or blue pricing? So those are the sorts of issues we're seeing on offtake contracts. In parallel, then, it's really building the government revenue support models, like the UK one, very advanced. They're saying, you know, very clearly it's likely to be a CFD. We're hoping we'll be doing our first UK CFD projects in hydrogen in 2023. So it is coming.
Well, thanks, Michael. That must indeed be fascinating and lots of fun assisting our clients in making those choices in how to structure their projects. Matthias, does this resonate with you for the APAC region?
It does very much, Jochen. And I think all the challenges that Michael has highlighted are equally relevant for the projects and also the supply chain management out here. I mean, there are, speaking just up on a few of them, we don't have comprehensive systems here like the Europe's taxonomy or the certification scheme. There's some discussion about guarantee of origin certificates in Australia, but that's all fairly recent and it is only focused on the production and not on derivative products for the time being. So the themes around certification and traceability, which I think Michael has referred to, which will be quite key going forward, they're still very much at an early development stage, which also means that there's a real challenge for the development of the bigger long-term projects here, but also for the Middle Eastern projects that look to export to Asia, for instance. We also don't really have any sort of widely used carbon trading or taxation schemes. There's nothing like the well-established European ETS scheme, and the idea of CBAM seems slightly exotic here. So there are some initial moves that you see in Japan trying to create a demonstration carbon market. There's some movement in Australia where people are discussing a carbon tax and a cap and trade system for emissions. But overall, I think it's very early days here as well. Michael noted the importance of subsidies and public support schemes. Well, I think there are some out here, but that's very much work in progress still. And especially when it comes to the operating phase, Michael, you mentioned CCFDs, and I think that's going to be one key in Germany. You have the Global H2 initiative, which also helps with that. There's a long way to go over here in Asia. But Jochen, I'm sort of reflecting on the fact, on two things that you said. First of all, there's a title, which is how to make a project a success. And we seem to be sort of all gloomy, and this may all sound very daunting. But actually, I really don't think it is. I think to me, this is just the nature of the beast, and it's to be expected in a transition of the magnitude like the one that we're going through at the moment. It's also, and thank you, Michael, for referring to my age in this context. But it's really not the first time we're doing this kind of thing. I am indeed old enough to remember the growing pains that we went through when LNG was the new kid of the block, and see where we got to. Maybe last but not least, Jochen, you mentioned a word that seems sort of heresy in the context of lawyers. Lawyers are not meant to have fun, I think. But actually, me personally, and I think we all are really having a lot of fun and really enjoy working very closely with every day with our clients, trying to find practical solutions to all of these issues. And in doing so, and I think that's very important, we are actually shaping the market.
And that's fun. Thank you, Matthias. Michael, this is a bit more holistic, I guess, but interesting with your experience on the different continents. This whole topic having such a global dimension, shouldn't we agree on applying shared standards, identical standards, not just within one region, but more broadly, for instance, on HSE topics? But Mike, what's your view on this?
Yeah, it is a critical point. And, you know, we don't have a unified definition of what green hydrogen means, or you know, I'm seeing it play out in other sectors. You know, we don't have it in green steel, for example, and there is that is a problem. And so I think the short answer is yes, that would be great, and I think we all need to encourage the industry, and I think industry recognizes that there's advantage in doing so. But you'll get blocks like the EU, I think, will drive that agenda. You've got it playing out in parallel with CBAM and these other mechanisms that are designed to level the playing field. But it is one of the conversations we have when we're structuring these projects. You know, the ones we're doing at the moment are, and we were having this conversation actually with a client very recently about shades of green. Most of the ones we're doing at the moment are, you know, the greenest of the green. And that gives you a lot of confidence. You know, you look at the projects in the Middle East, if they're being built with dedicated power, their own integrated power development that is solar and wind, you know, you can't really get much greener, but there are still risks. You could look behind that and say, well, okay, you know, related infrastructure, is that green, or actually, you know, where are the panels coming from, and how green are those? So I think you've always got those issues. The projects at the moment are definitely as green as you can do it, and so it's hard to see how you could have a taxonomy system or a definition that doesn't, you know, sort of keep you at the top. I think the bigger risk for those projects is more that the taxonomy accommodates abated brown or abated grey in the case of hydrogen and ammonia, which gives them a similar level of greenness as the super green, the greenest green. And that the risk there, the danger there, is it erodes your premium. I mean, I view that all really as commercial risks. But it is a problem. And I think the sooner we can have clarity on what the greenest green looks, you know, what the different shades are, and really what approach governments want to take to abated brown or abated grey or blue ammonia, blue hydrogen, blue ammonia in our case, the better. But in the meantime, the projects that we're seeing are going for the greenest of green, and having the confidence then to say, well, no matter what happens, we're going to be top of the tree.
And maybe just to add into this, Michael, I think it may not be just the governments that are driving this, because I think a lot of it will be financiers and the public opinion that will determine eventually what financiers are still willing to support. So I think there's a bit of a mixture where the financial markets, the ESG aspects, and government initiatives will all need to come together.
Yeah. I think a lot of it will depend on consumers buying into the branding as well on these shades of green. You know, there must be. I'm certainly a believer that there is a pocket of consumer, if not a majority of consumers, who will see the value in true green rather than greenwashed or brand, you know, or sort of claims to be green, which are of a lesser nature. And so I think government will drive it, but actually a lot of it needs to come and will come from the way that consumers approach the different shades.
Yeah. Well, talking about value then and those different shades, I think this is also a very burning question from the EU perspective to I think, the both of you. Would you be able to give an insight into the price per kilogram of blue or green hydrogen in your regions, and how they compare, how far away are they from grey hydrogen? So essentially, I guess the question in essence is, how much time do we need to get to a competitive price point there?
I think the interesting question is how off-takers are getting comfortable with long-term market risk. And, you know, what we're seeing there are larger players taking a really holistic view of the market. And the way they are, as I understand the way they're looking at things, it is linked to their wider ambitions in a market where they can see long-term value. It's a hard one to read, because you expect pricing to come down as production increases, but we're in this weird world of driving demand at the same time as supply. And actually, I think the view an off-taker might take is that demand is still going to grow faster than supply, even as we ramp up supply, and that's going to hold up pricing on the green premium. But I'm a very firm believer that it will be around, that premium will be around for a long time. Arguably, it's going to grow, because I think it comes down to your view of the demand and supply curves and kind of when they cross. And my view is that they're very likely to they're not going to cross anytime soon.
I completely agree with this. Maybe just to add to this, I think one of the vital elements that will determine where this is going is actually the role of China as an electrolyzer producing country, and the role or the attitude that regions like the EU and others will take towards using large-scale sort of Chinese-made electrolyzers, both in terms of quality, in terms of taxonomy, sort of how they were manufactured, but also just in terms of overall trade policies. So, I mean, we all know what happened to solar cells. There's a lot of people and a lot of countries in the world that are vying to become electrolyzer suppliers, and I'm sitting in a region where that is included in that thought. But I think, to me, sort of what will happen in China in that respect and how the world reacts to it, I think will have a big impact on price differentials.
Thank you, Matthias and Michael, for sharing your experiences. And thank you for listening to this third and final part of our podcast series on hydrogen. You can find the other two parts on our website. Should you have any questions, please check our website or contact Marinus Winters, Charles Honnet or me, or of course your regular A&O contact. We hope to see you soon during one of our other events.